I was busy with my tongue doing the itchy part of my leg when Ted called for me. I thought, darn it, this is not a good time. But I heard that note in his voice, so I stopped and went to find him. All I had to do was follow the cord, which is a rich, shining gold today. He was standing in the living room. His eyes were gone. Kitten, he said, over and over. The memories moved in him like worms under the skin. There was thunder in the air. This was a bad one.
Welcome to the Waterstones podcast. I'm Will Rycroft, and in this episode of This Is the Book, we are going to visit the last house on Needless Street, the dark, compelling new novel from Katrina Ward. This is the kind of book that's hard to describe, and harder still to discuss without spoiling. But rather than make the shortest episode ever in which we simply say, just read it, we're going to give you a sense of the place, the people, and the atmosphere of this novel, which has got writers with a pedigree like Stephen King himself reaching for the superlatives. So what can we say? We begin with Miranda Dewis, Senior Commissioning Editor at Viper Books, and her first impressions on reading this singular novel.
I remember going into publishing meetings over a couple of weeks while I was reading it, and people asked me what submissions I was reading, and me saying, oh, well, I'm reading this one book, and I don't really know what's going on, but there's a cat, and it started talking. I think it's a bit mad, but the writing is so good that I'm just going to go with it.
Just go with it will be something of a mantra in this episode, in which we try not to spoil the new book from Katrina Ward, who had already made an impression with her gothic debut Raw Blood, and then the folk horror of Little Eve, which followed it. The new book isn't so easy to categorise, and not just because of the talking cat that opened this episode. We could say that it's a novel about a disappearance and a sister looking for revenge, that it's also the story of a man called Ted, who lives with his daughter and his cat at the end of the street in the last house before the woods. And yet, maybe it isn't. With such an intricately plotted book and multiple narrators, I began by asking Katrina where she had first begun with her writing of it.
I wrote Olivia the cat first, because I thought that she becomes almost the audience surrogate in the form of being the inner detective inside the novel. She investigates and interrogates some of the strange happenings. So I wanted to get her voice right first. Also, I just, you know, what the hell does a cat sound like? We just don't know. We just don't know. And, you know, we will never know these, because there's a lot of anthropomorphism that goes on with cats, isn't there? We think because they have these faces that don't emote in the way that we do, that we attribute all sorts of things to them, this sort of sphinx-like calm, manipulative and cunning nature, a superior kind of sneering sort of manner. Cats are very unlikely to be feeling any of these things at all. Probably just thinking about cheese. But, I was trying to think about... It became a more complex question, really. So what, not only what is a cat like, but because Olivia fulfills she fulfills a need in the book that she, the same need that she fulfills for Ted, really, which is that she provides comfort and a little bit of reason in a novel, which is sadly, say it though I do myself, sadly lacking in all these things. she's a bit of a linchpin. So it became about what we need from cats and what Ted specifically needs from her. And that's how the voice sort of grew. And I had great fun with it. You know, I don't, as a kind of a writer of the darker end of things, you don't often get to write funny stuff. You don't often get to access like the slightly charming and weird and write things and create characters like that. So for me, it was a huge joy.
And one of the first people to read those pages was Jenny Saville, Katrina's literary agent.
I remember the cat. I just remember reading Olivia and thinking, wow, I really love this. And I think lots of people will love this too. And I had a conversation with Kat about it and just sort of reassured her that I thought it was brilliant. And, you know, obviously there's a worry that some people won't get it. And when it went on submission, some editors didn't, and that's fine. Not everyone's going to love it. It's such a brave thing to do. It's audacious to have a speaking cat in an adult book. I mean, I represent children's books as well, and there's plenty of talking animals in those, but this is the first time I'd come across a talking animal in an adult, a serious adult book. And I love it. I actually think Olivia is possibly the moral centre of the story, and that's all I'm going to say on her.
Yes, I mean, I think luckily, because I was so subsumed in my own idea, I didn't quite think about what an incredibly idiotic idea it was to try and sell this book like this. I just was sort of in her. I felt like she was so necessary and indeed and intrinsic to the plot that I didn't really think carefully enough about how what a risk it was. And I talked about it with Jenny actually at a certain point, and I was like, oh, you know, have I just gone too far? have I written an unsellable, ridiculous book? And she was like, well, I don't think so. we talked about whether one should change the cat and, you know, and make the cat into a character who was human, who was a human companion, and perhaps that would make it more palatable. And we both decided that we didn't want to do that because it would denature the book to such a degree and remove a huge part of what of its mechanics and what made it interesting. So we decided we'd rather not sell it at all. luckily, we weren't forced to that point.
I think it's really important as an agent to let a writer follow their nose, follow their instinct, even if that seems to be going counter to where the market is at that moment in time. It's really important, otherwise it won't work. And Kat clearly was coming from such a strong, authentic place with the idea of Olivia, and in fact the other characters as well, that how could I stop that? I mean, I just thought that was fantastic, and I wouldn't have been a very good agent if I'd said, do you know what, this, I don't think people are going to get this. Yeah, that was my job, really, just to make sure that she continued, and I'm so glad that she did.
I can remember almost exactly where I was when I first thought of the idea that sort of blossomed into the idea for Needler Street, which is, I used to live, I don't anymore, in Willesden, which is, in fact, on the street where Dennis Nielsen used to prey on, used to get his victims, select his victims from. So, and you can sort of see the after effects of that. I think people still remember it, even now, because all of these Irish pubs, which are where I think, you know, you used to find vulnerable or sometimes even homeless young men, now have signs up in the windows saying, unless we know your face, you can't come in, which is a very strange idea for a pub, really. You know, serial killers are a source of great interest to me, as they, I think they are to many, many people. But particularly I started to think about this thing of the bond that people who have this innate capacity for the monstrous can form with an animal. So when Dennis Nielsen was arrested, the only thing he really cared about, really had any regret for, was his dog, Bleep. He really worried about what would happen to the dog. He really loved Bleep, and Bleep really, you know, loved him. The dog was the only thing that could inspire any sort of, you know, affection, and was his constant companion. I mean, that famous saying about Dennis Nielsen, isn't it, that he was killing for company, killing so that he could keep people with him. He did, in fact, manage to keep one, you know, sentient being with him, which was Bleep. So I wanted to write about a serial killer and his cat. This is the genesis of the book. It evolved into something much more multi-limbed and strange. But that was the first impulse.
It was a complete first draft that needed some work. And there were places where I was confused. And so that was also my job, to say to her, hey, you know, this bit in, you know, chapter 10, what's going on? Because I don't get it. And then there were other bits that I didn't get that I realized I wasn't supposed to get until later, which was really exciting. Because I think the thing about Kat is she really knows what she's doing, you know, and she'll present you with all the facts and she'll carry you along and you think you know where this is going. And then suddenly you realize, oh, that's a bit weird. I saw it whole from the beginning and I could see what she was planning to do as well.
I think the plot of this book is a piece of the most fiddly, incredibly intricate, tiny pieces of clockwork, each working interdependently and independently of one another. It was the biggest challenge I've had as a writer, I think. And I, again, poor darling Jenny, I was like, Jenny, I don't know if I can do this. And she said, just very gently, but in this quite firm way, I just want you to try. And I was like, okay, I can do that. I can try. But it's a challenge that I set myself, sort of huge landscape of a book. And, you know, with lots of different thematic and plot challenges. And just because it is what the subject matter requires, but it was also at a point where I'd written these two books, which were kind of, I think, more, you could safely say they're quite twisty, but perhaps they're a bit more traditional in their Northern Gothic setting, you know, lonely, you know, distressed girls on moors. But I wanted it to be a departure. And I also thought I was just ready to write something that was the most, I suppose, for want of a better word, the most bonkers thing I could think of. And also with the research I'd done, I was very inspired to make it something really special and unusual and full of intricate little moving parts. It definitely is the hardest thing I've ever done. But at the same time, perhaps the most rewarding as well, because I nearly drove myself mad with it, but it was incredibly fulfilling when finally I realised quite late in the game that it was going to work.
Together with Jenny, another person who helped to map out the topography of the novel was editor Miranda Jewis, who developed a now infamous colour-coded spreadsheet.
Kat will know I'm a fussy biscuit when it comes to anything that has any kind of mystery in it in terms of editing. I like to kind of make sure all the breadcrumbs line up. So if you've got, you know, in this book, there are probably like 4 or 5 mysteries, essentially, that all kind of arc through the book. And so I wanted to kind of work back and make sure they were all signposted very, very subtly. But also there were parts of the book that there's the character of Ted's mother who he thinks about and talks about. And I thought she was fascinating. And I got to the end of the book the first time I read it and I thought, I need to know more about this woman who we only ever hear about through other people's memories. But I asked Kat to put in a lot more of her because I was itching to know more about her and all her horrible little ways. So there was a lot of that, I suppose. It was asking Kat to add things because I wanted to know more about them. But I hope that will help the readers and they'll enjoy knowing more about Mummy too.
All this talk of the landscape of the novel led me to think about its location. As someone who grew up living in different parts of the world, including Kenya, Madagascar, Morocco and the Yemen, why did Katrina choose to set the novel in the US?
Despite the fact that I talk like this, you know, I'm an American. I was born in America and I grew up in America. I never really lived here until I went to university. So for me, that's a big part of my identity and who I am. And I think it was part of, when I really wanted to make this book into a departure, I wanted to perhaps, there was a, you know, mine a different area of, you know, as you do of your personal life to make, you know, to make the book. I think also that very particular part of the world, you know, the Pacific Northwest and those forests, those ancient forests with those Jurassic-sized ferns, you know, that are like almost as tall as you are. There's something so haunting about them. I think it's the only temperate rainforest in the world, which gives it this sort of eerie and a quality of not quite fitting in to the established order of things. And, you know, so it feels right. It feels like a place that can swallow people up. It can would take you and never give you back. You can walk into the wilderness there and not be found. And indeed, for this book in particular, it seemed right. It's historically a very well-trodden hunting ground for serial killers. I think a big part of the book is about a disappearance by a lake. A little girl disappears, as children have been disappearing in the area for years, disappears taken in, you know, in the middle of the day from the shores of a lake. And I have, you know, I had in my mind the disappearances at Lake Sammamish, which is where Ted Bundy abducted two women, Denise Nasland and Janice Ott, in the space of a couple of hours, I think, in the blazing sunshine, among crowds of thousands who were, you know, on a Memorial Day weekend, huge amounts of people. And they were found, yeah, some months later on a wooded hillside, and there's something about the land around there that has got the indifference of the wilderness. It's got no interest in the doings of people, really. It just is. So there's something about that I thought was the perfect backdrop to this novel. And it's got a mind of its own, you know, and that in itself is kind of eerie.
And with the novel now ready to send out to early readers, we return to one of the first.
When I first finished it, I'd actually finished it about sort of 5:25 on the train home, rushing to collect my daughter from nursery. And I almost missed my stop because I was just had this gut punch at the end of just how much this book had done. And I actually rang up Kat's agent, Jenny, running from the train station to my daughter's nursery. So I've just finished it. Don't do anything. I'm going to go to a publishing meeting. Don't sell it. I think she must have thought I was a bit mad. We just had that immediate hit. And I do really enjoy the more sort of traditional thrillers that you can read and enjoy and have a wonderful time and then put down and not think about that much. There's a huge market for that, and I enjoy them very much as well. But when you find something like this that both has mysteries and heart and these wonderful characters and also some really satisfying twists, it's just a full package, and it's a very rare thing to find. And I think, yes, that's definitely why I love it so much.
Whilst browsing in your local Waterstones, you may well have picked up a book and been caught by the blurb from another writer praising the novel in your hands. And getting quotes is all part of the publicity game. But as we hear from three authors whose names you'll find adorning this jacket, you'll discover that this book, as ever, was a little different. First, we hear from Joanne Harris, best-selling author of Chocolat and most recently The Strawberry Thief, and Chris Whittaker, award-winning thriller writer and author of former Waterstones Thriller of the Month, We Begin at the End.
Well, in the case of this book, I actually asked for the proof. I don't often do this. I try to discourage people from sending me too many proofs. But I'd already read Raw Blood, which I thought was extraordinary, but which was also a sign that the next book would be much better. I mean, to me, Raw Blood was perfectly good, well-written gothic. But I thought, you know what? The next thing she's going to do, that's the thing that's going to be worth watching. And so I really wanted to read this one. And indeed it was. It's a whole step ahead, and it's so interestingly written. I mean, she's a very good stylist anyway. She's very good at characterization. But this is so intriguingly structured, and the voices are so distinct and original. And the surprises when they come are genuinely surprising. It takes a lot to surprise me nowadays because I read a lot of psychological thrillers, and most of the time I can see the surprises coming. And in this case, absolutely not. Wham, wham, wham. Every time a whammy.
Yeah, I saw some stuff on Twitter, and I never, ever ask for a book because I think there's something cheeky about it. You know, if someone wants to send me a book, they can send me a book. But I'm friends with Miranda, who publishes the book, and I sent her a message saying I'm really excited for the book, which is kind of code for if there's any spare proofs, I really, really want one. And then luckily one arrived not that long after. But it's like with a lot of these books, I guess you see it day to day, you know, it's a publisher's job to hype the book as much as they can. And sometimes everything gets kind of lost, doesn't it? Because every book is being called the next big book, and this is the best book you'll read this year. And The Last House on Needless Street is probably the best book I read last year. It's just absolutely brilliant. And And I wasn't prepared. I knew kind of from the first chapter, from the opening, from when we get to meet Ted, even from the first line, that it was going to be special and different and just kind of everything that everyone said it would be. And I was thrilled by that, actually.
Well, yes, there are a lot of psychological thrillers out there. Some of them are well plotted. Some of them are well written. Not all of them are both. This one is both. What you've got here is a really good style of writing, which is neither self-conscious and pretentious nor schlocky and predictable. So you've got this very strong narrative voice, and you've got the separation of these very interesting characters that keep moving from one identity to another, but you can always tell who's talking. That's a difficult trick to pull off for anybody, and particularly within the context of such a very intricate plot. I think this is definitely a literary psychological thriller. I mean, it should be winning prizes.
Yeah, I read a hell of a lot, and I work in a library as well, so I'm forever just grabbing every book that I like the look of. But I never try and guess the end, and I'm never able to. I'm not very good at it. I think I don't go looking for it. I never would have guessed it in this book in a million years. But yeah, it's impressive. It's Ted as a character, you know, to humanise someone so apparently chilling, you know, there's a real skill to that. And kind of everything on the page is humanised. And I don't just mean like Olivia, who's my favourite, a talking cat. I mean, you know, the house and the woods, and they're more than characters. I could feel what Ted felt, and that in itself is quietly disturbing. and Lauren as well, you know, they are so distinct. I mean, Lauren's really tough, and you kind of wonder just what she's been through, and you're willing her to escape, but because of her situation, she's got no boundaries. And you read these scenes where she's being awful, and it's so cleverly done, because you have to empathize with her, but you end up also empathizing with Ted. And you kind of wonder how that's happened. You know, you read back a passage over and over again and think, why am I feeling this way? And I think it's rare. It's rare for a book to do that. And you have Dee as well. And there's some heart-stopping moments when she's investigating Ted, and you're kind of reading through your fingers. She's looking for her sister, and she's looking for atonement. And as the story goes on, you worry that she's not going to find either of those things.
And on the front of the book, together with a quote from some guy called Stephen King, there is another from former Waterstones Children's Book Prize winner Kieran Millward Hargrave, who had been a fan of Katrina's previous books. Did she perhaps have a favourite character in the new one?
Do you need to ask me who my favourite was? So Olivia, the talking cat, is of course my absolute favourite. She doesn't actually talk so that the characters can hear her, but we the reader get a fabulous insight into her mind, and she really provides some of that comedy that you really need in a book like this, that goes, it doesn't shy away from those really just awful, like awful places. You really needed her to carry you through, and she's just hilarious. She wants to host a talk show called Catching Up with Olivia, and it sounds bonkers, because it is. This book is bonkers, but in the best way. And as you've said, it's so, the way it plays with form, it's so masterful. I sort of turned off my writer's head and just had to enjoy it as a reader, because if I had my writer's head on, I'd just be like, how has she done that? I want to do that. Why can't I do that? So I had to really just go to my happy place of a reader to read this, because just in every aspect, I think it surpasses so much of what I read, and I read so widely. I just think it's exceptional. I really think that this will be a book that will lift Katrina out of, and I think genres are wonderful and I love reading genre fiction, but it will lift her out of that gothic horror thriller genre. And I could really see this even becoming a book club book, even with all its strangeness, because the psychological portraits that she manages to achieve, and the complex familial relationships, the relationship between the protagonist, well, one of the protagonists, Ted, and his daughter Lauren, and the mystery around that. And it is, you know, it is dark, it is scary, but it's also full of these moments, kind of life-affirming moments of love and light and Olivia. So I would really encourage people who think this might not be in their wheelhouse to pick it up, because it's just got it really does have something for everyone, in my opinion.
And so The Last House on Needless Street heads out and into the hands of readers, leaving my last question for Katrina. Why is she drawn to write about such dark subjects, and what does she hope readers will take away from this book after all the twists, turns and reveals are done?
I think there's something about writing the things down that we're afraid of, that has a sort of almost like a, maybe I've just got a vaccination on the brain because I've just been vaccinated, but there's a sort of inoculating effect. Writing down the things that scare you most, and then by extension, sharing them. So it's like reaching out a hand across, you know, however much time and space, to take someone else's hand and be like, I'm afraid of this too. It's a great collective exercise in empathy, really. It's you saying, this is the most terrifying thing I can think of. Then that, you know, that bit of your brain that works late at night going, what if, what if, or what if, what if. And the worst things it can come up with, you can put on the page, and if not neutralize, at least have that warm feeling of being seen and recognized and knowing that other people are afraid of it too. I think I've been thinking a lot about this, because it is a question you ask yourself, like, why do I write things like this? Why, God, why? And, you know, I think there's perhaps a kind of assumption that people who write things like this are less afraid than others, whereas I actually think we're more afraid. I think the only reason you can write something effectively is if you're genuinely terrified of it. If you want to make it frightening, it won't work unless you're genuinely really frightened. The darker side of literature has always been a kind of repository for your fears, where you can let them out, but in a safe, contained environment. And I think there's something in that that people have really gravitate to, or writers and readers. It's a huge, a strange shared experience, because I think that's one thing we all have in common, no matter who we are. We know what it's like to be afraid. It goes back slightly to that thing of, wherever horror is found, hopefully compassion should be found too. You know, they should really go together, because you shouldn't be able to feel horror without an impulse towards compassion. But the big thing that lies at the heart, at the beating heart of the book, as it were, is something that hopefully, when you get to the point where the book reveals itself, I hope that people feel the same sense of awe and at the world that I did, at the strangeness of the world, and perhaps the value of not taking things at face value and treating each other with kindness. Is that vague enough? I think.
Huge thanks to everyone who contributed to this episode. The Last House on Needless Street is out now, and signed copies with our blood red sprayed edge are currently available on waterstones.com. We head to warmer climes in our next episode of This Is the Book, as Leonie Ross enchants us with This One Sky Day. And our other series, How We Made, shares its first episode soon, as we travel back in time with double Booker Prize winner Dame Hilary Mantel to discover exactly how her magnificent Cromwell trilogy began with Wolf Hall. See you then.